Please open your Bibles to Acts chapter number 11, verse 25, as we consider the continued growth of the church at Antioch. This is a majority Gentile church, and because of that, we have the arrival of someone that God has already selected for ministry to that group. So Acts chapter number 11, verse 25 said, "So Barnabas went to Tarsus to look for Saul. And when he'd found him, he brought him to Antioch. And for a whole year, they met with the church and taught a great many people." So that whole year seems to be the full year of 43. Because we know in the story that's coming up in the next chapter that it will be the year 44. Now, Barnabas, I suggest you, remembered that Saul's testimony included this bit of information that Jesus had tapped him for ministry to the Gentiles. I think it's possible that when Barnabas heard this, he assumed that that meant ministry to proselytes. But now that the church has expanded into the Gentile world, I believe Barnabas realizes that meant a bigger thing than he thought. So he goes, finds Saul, brings him back, and together they minister in the church at Antioch, making great inroads into both the Jewish and Gentile community. But because there are a lot more Gentiles in a ratio of the world, then there are a lot more Gentiles that become believers in Jesus in this congregation. And so we were told, this is where we finished up, in Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians. That is because of the language that's being used. Greek is the common language of the people in Antioch, especially amongst the Gentiles. And so they just take the word Christos, which is Greek for anointed one, and they apply it to the group of people who embrace that belief system and call them Christanoi, Christians. And so I very much love the term Christian because it describes how those with that name are devoted to the one who carried out that act of salvation by being the anointed one of God. Now, let's see what happens next in Antioch. It says, "In these days, prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch." Now, that can be a little bit confusing for some of you that are newer to the Bible. Jerusalem is always counted as the highest place on earth from a Jewish context, from a religious context. So anywhere you go, regardless of its altitude or regardless of its placement on a map, you are going down from Jerusalem. So we have Jewish prophets that came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. This is part of an effort to assist the growth of this new congregation. Now, one of them, named Agabus, stood up and foretold by the Spirit that there would be a great famine over all the world. This took place in the days of Claudius. Now, Claudius became emperor in 41. And so I'm telling you that more than likely, these prophets were ministering in Antioch in 44, very early in 44. And we know from other sources that there were drought conditions and famine situations during this exact period of time in this particular part of the world. And so what's happening here is Agabus is not just simply announcing about this, but he is urging the church at Antioch to do something in reference to this. So verse 29, the disciples determined, everyone according to his ability, to send relief to the brothers living in Judea. Now, the Jewish believers in Jesus at Jerusalem had already kind of closed ranks early on in the history of the church because they'd been kicked out of the synagogue system. And so the poor people amongst the Jewish believers in Jesus no longer had access to the tithe supplies that were intended for poor people. So the church had to help. And that was when Barnabas, as a leader, he gave up some of his personal property, sold it, and took that money and gave it to the apostles, gave it to the church to be used for the poor people among them. And that became the habit within the church. Those who are better off make sure that those who are having a tough time are being able to be taken care of out of church funds. The Church of Jerusalem is going to get hit hard again because of this famine. And they're going to need outside sources of income and support in order to get through this tough time. So the Gentile believers, as the majority of the church at Antioch, voluntarily start giving large sums of money. And folks, you should imagine that this is probably the equivalent of several hundreds of thousands of dollars that these guys would have gotten together and sent south. So they send this relief money south in the custody of two individuals they trust to take care of this business. Verse 30, they did so, sending it to the elders, that is the leaders in the church at Jerusalem, by the hand of Barnabas and Saul. Now, this will apparently be the first time that Saul is back at Jerusalem since he left the area back in 36. So now it's 44. So he's been gone for about 8 years from the Holy Land. And now he's coming back as a representative of the church at Antioch in support of the church at Jerusalem. Chapter 12 tells us what happened in the spring of 44. It says, about that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. So Herod Agrippa I, as he grows into this position of leadership as the king of the Jews, he comes to the conclusion that he should do what he can to prosecute and annihilate this Jesus of Nazareth cult that has grown up over the last decade. And so the first thing he does, verse 2, he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. So James and John are the sons of Zebedee. They were part of that inner circle of Jesus, along with Simon Peter. And so James is a very vocal, very active leader in the church at Jerusalem in 44. And so that makes him a target. He gets arrested, put on trial, convicted, and then because his family, he and James and John, have, that is, he, his family, including his brother John, have Roman citizenship, he is executed by the sword. He has his head chopped off. Now, when Herod Agrippa saw that it pleased the Jews that he'd done this, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now, he's probably got his spies, his intel organization out there trying to find any of these apostles, and particularly those who were in high leadership, like James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Peter, and probably James, the half-brother of Jesus, who is the apostle to the church at Jerusalem. But the only other guy he can get his hands on at this point is Simon Peter, and that's a pretty big prize, isn't it? This was during the days of unleavened bread, so that tells us it is in the spring of 44. When he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out to the people. So here we are, 11 years to the feast time after the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And Herod Agrippa I has Peter being held in custody during Passover time, but he wants to wait until after the festivities are all finished. Then he will bring Peter out, go through the motions of a trial, because he already figures he's going to condemn him, and then he will execute him by crucifixion. Now, crucifixion is for non-citizens, and so this helps us understand a little bit about Peter's background. Now, Jesus has already told Peter that he will be crucified. That's from John chapter 21. But Jesus had indicated this would happen when Peter was an old man. And that's not going to be for a few years yet. But more than likely, Peter is in his 40s as this story is taking place. That's not terribly old. So he is now in custody with four rotating squads of soldiers keeping track of him till his trial and execution. Each squad is four individual soldiers. More than likely, they have four guys on duty, and the rest are elsewhere, sleeping or in their own time off. And then every 4 hours, they swap out. And so, Peter is considered a very high-profile prisoner. You can tell by this special attention. So Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. So the church, made up of who knows how many tens of thousands of Jews here in the city of Jerusalem, they are meeting all over the place, praying for him. We know of at least one that will be mentioned here in a little bit, a prayer meeting that's going on all night long at the home of a relative of Barnabas, a woman by the name of Mary, who has a son named John Mark. And we will get to that detail momentarily. Verse 6, now when Herod was about to bring him out, so Passover festivities are all over with, and now it's time for the trial. So we're in the middle of the night, the wee hours of the morning. I would suggest you probably in the final watch of the night, the watch that ran from about, I think, about 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the morning. So Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. So Peter is sleeping. That's pretty amazing. The soldiers are not asleep. Do not picture them that way. They are either sitting at attention, guard attention, not very far from Peter because they're chained to him on each side, or they're standing nearby, guarding him. And then there are two other soldiers, because remember, we got four total. Two other soldiers that are outside the cell door. So we've got four people that can put eyes on Peter at any moment. And they rotate probably every 4 hours with other sentries. Well, that's not going to stop God from making a miraculous jailbreak. Verse 7, "Behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone in the cell." So here comes the angel of the Lord bringing with him the glory of the Lord, and he just pops into the cell. Immediately, he struck Peter on the side. I don't know if he poked him with his hand or he kicked him with his toe, but he basically woke him up and then was saying to him, "Get up quickly." And the chains fell off his hands. Now, folks, you have to imagine here, from the perspective of these soldiers, they see none of this. None of this. God apparently puts them in some sort of suspended animation, some sort of daze, where from their perspective, one moment they will be awake, chained to Peter, and the next moment, at sunrise apparently, Peter will suddenly be gone, and the chain will be, his part of the chain will be laying down on the floor or on the cot area. And they will have no explanation as to where he went. It will seem as if he just poofed out of existence. But this is what happens from Peter's perspective. The angel said to him, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." So he was probably stripped down to his basic chiton, his main undergarment. That was worn close to the skin. So Peter tells him, or excuse me, the angel tells him, "Get yourself all dressed, put your sandals on, let's go." So he did so. And then he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And so he went out and followed him. He did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought that he was seeing a vision. So Peter thinks he's dreaming about this jailbreak. He doesn't realize this is really happening to him. And what happens? Well, they walk out of the jail cell. So the jail cell door has to open. Those two soldiers that are on guard there, they don't see a thing. Verse 10 says, "When they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city." Now, I believe that this jail cell was likely located in the Tower of Antonia, the fortress that guards the northeast corner of the Temple Mount. This is where about 600 Roman soldiers were housed all year round, because they had a rotating guard duty, not just simply to the city, but particularly around the Temple Mount itself, to keep the peace there with hundreds of thousands of people coming and going. Whenever Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles happened, when the population of Jerusalem swelled up to about 1 million plus, then they would bring even more Roman soldiers up from Caesarea to be here in the Antonia Tower. And the Roman prefect at this time is actually King Agrippa I. So he represents the government of Rome over the city of Jerusalem, over Judea. And so more than likely, he would have kept his prisoners in the Praetorium, which is the Tower of Antonia. So there's plenty of other guards on duty throughout the night, and some of them apparently were also put into this suspended animation or into this trance, so that Peter is led by the angel straight through the front gate that led into the city. In fact, verse 10, again, it says, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened for them of its own accord. And they went out, and then they went along one street, and immediately the angel left him. Now, in my mind, I imagine this being the front gate, which opened onto a multi-covered pavement on a street that went between the Antonia and the northern wall of the Temple Mount. This pavement is mentioned in the gospel story because it's where Pilate brought his judgment seat out to, because the Jews wouldn't go inside the praetorium because it was Passover time. So he brought his judgment seat out the front gate and put it on this multicolored pavement and condemned Jesus to death officially. So I believe that's exactly where Peter is brought out of. And then the gate closes back on its own. The jail cell door had also closed back on its own. And everything was left as if Peter were still in custody. Now, Peter, being left by the angel, came to himself. It suddenly dawns on him that this really happened, that God sent an angel and sprang him from jail. Now, why did God not intervene on behalf of James? None of us can know. We just don't have enough information to answer that question. The best we can do is speculate like this. Somehow, Peter's death would have interfered with God's key intentions of ministry, while James's death apparently did not. And so God intervened to keep the plan moving forward. But back to the Peter story. Now that he realizes that he's been rescued, he said to himself, "Now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name is Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So somehow Mary and Barnabas are related, and John Mark, her son, will eventually be a close associate of Barnabas, Saul, who becomes Paul, and then eventually, when Peter is an old man, in his 60s, possibly even age 70, ministering for the last part of his life at Rome, John Mark will be his right-hand assistant. And this is how the Gospel of John Mark came into existence. The tradition tells us, early history tells us, that John Mark wrote down for other people a copy of Peter's stories about Jesus, and that once Peter was dead, and that'd be right around 65 or so. So we're talking about a good 20 years after this story. John Mark then took all of that information and produced the gospel. And so that's why we talk about the Gospel of John Mark being the recollections of Peter. So there's a prayer meeting happening in this little component of the church at Jerusalem at Mary's house. And so Peter knows about this. So he goes there. Verse 13, when he knocked at the door of the gateway, this is the entry hallway for a Mediterranean-style house that has a central courtyard. So he's knocking at the gateway, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice in her joy, she didn't open the gate, but she ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. So she's so excited about this, she goes in and tells them, Peter's at the gate. He's at the gate. Now they said to her, you're out of your mind, which is hilarious when you think about it. What are they doing here in the wee hours of the morning? They're praying for Peter to be released. Well, he just got released and they don't believe it. So they said to her, you're out of your mind. But she kept insisting that it was so. And they kept saying, oh, it has to be his angel. Now, it seems as if there was some sort of belief that people's angels look like them. That is, their guardian angels. And it seems as if what these guys are thinking is that when Peter was executed, maybe he got executed early, that his angel then came to announce that to this group in a supernatural way. And so they're not happy that perhaps it is his angel here. But Peter just continues knocking. And then when they opened, they saw him and they were amazed. It really is Peter. He motions to them with his hand to be silent because they must have really been doing a lot of talking and expressing how surprised they are that it's him and probably demanding, how did you get here? What happened? And so he gets them to be quiet, and then he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. So he goes through his story that we just read here. Luke probably got this information from Peter himself. Then he said, tell these things to James, that's the half-brother of Jesus, and the apostle to the church at Jerusalem. So he's kind of the leader of the church. Tell these things to James and to the brothers. Then he departed and he went to another place. So Peter goes underground, but also wants the church leadership to know, I'm okay. God's angel rescued me.